From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. For 3 years, Ayub Nouri was very good at solving problems for Western journalists covering the war in Iraq. He was known as a fixer, an interpreter, guide, source finder, and occasional lifesaver. On today's Fresh Air, Nouri tells us how he did more and more original reporting and eventually got his own byline. Also, we talk with Matt Weiner. He's a TV writer and producer who's created a new series called Mad Men about hard-working, hard-drinking advertising executives in 1960 in New York City. It airs on the AMC cable network. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. When Americans see, read, and hear stories from Iraq, they're usually unaware that behind the reporting of Western journalists are a cadre of Iraqis who've served as guides and translators for their stories. In the war zone, they're called fixers. Working at great personal risk, these Iraqis use their language skills and knowledge of local culture, politics, and religion to find sources for their Western colleagues and help them stay out of danger. Our guest Ayub Nouri is an Iraqi Kurd who served as a fixer for Western journalists in Iraq for 3 years. Over time, he played a greater role in reporting and eventually began filing stories under his own byline. Last summer, he came to the United States to attend the Columbia School of Journalism, and he recently wrote a story about his experiences for the New York Times Magazine. Well, Ayub Nouri, welcome to Fresh Air. You write in your piece in the New York Times, you were born in 1979 and grew up around war, the Iran-Iraq war in northern Iraq. You were in Turkey hoping to get to Europe or the United States when the American-led invasion was approaching in 2003, and you decided to return to Iraq. Why?
Because I thought the war would really end all the tragedies and hardships in my country. That's why I decided to go back. At that time, I was desperate for change. I was desperate to get rid of the regime that was in Iraq, because I lived all my life until 2003 under bombardment and war, and all the reason for all that was Saddam Hussein and his regime. So what I really hoped, and my only vision, was for a prosperous Iraq, a democratic Iraq, and a free country. It didn't cross my mind for a second what's happening now at that time.
You know, there's this term fixer, which refers to Iraqis who assisted foreign journalists, and we think of them as needing translation, but it really goes far beyond that. What did you and other fixers provide for journalists besides translating conversations?
Yes, but before that, I would like to say that to me and to, I think, all the fixers in Iraq, the word fixer was new. We knew what does the word fixer mean, because we all spoke English and we know that fixer is someone who fixes something. But the foreign journalists, especially the American journalists, were using the term fixer to describe us, and we thought we were translators, but they described us, or they referred to us, as fixers. And what we did for them was we booked hotel rooms for them, we found sources for them to interview. Then we oriented the American journalists about the history, the culture, the politics, and the society of Iraq, because we were all from there. At the same time, we sensed danger. We told them distances between the cities. And after each interview, we explained to them what the interviewee meant by certain points and certain terms. So we were not only translating, we were doing everything for them, and all they had to do was to write their story at the end of the day.
You know, in the early months of the occupation, Western journalists were able to move around in Baghdad and in Iraq much more freely than they were able to later when the security situation worsened. And during that time, I was wondering if you could sort of describe, if you can, what kinds of cues that you would pick up on the street that a Western journalist might not, about, a checkpoint at an intersection by a militia, or the atmosphere at in a neighborhood or at a religious rally?
That's a good question, because survival as a reporter in a situation like Iraq or an environment like Iraq's merely depends on your precautions and your knowledge of the country. It is very important. I've survived until now by really taking precautions, knowing where I go, what would I say, what to dress, and how to behave and how to walk in the street. I have been in situations where somebody says a remark that smells danger, and I know if we spend more than half an hour or 15 minutes there, he will provoke other people and there might be a mob. It is very important. I've even sensed car bombs by analyzing the situation before that, and it has happened a few minutes later. So it is very important to see what people say and you talk to a number of people. It has happened many times. We were talking to a group of people, and other people were gathering around, and they were exchanging remarks among themselves and saying, what is this person doing here? What should we do about him or her? And in that situation, I would quickly warn the journalist to leave the area.
I'd like to return to something you said a moment ago, that there was one case where you actually sensed a danger of a car bomb, which turned out to be real. Describe what happened. What cues did you pick up that made you concerned about the potential of a car bomb?
This was just 2 days after the war started in March 2003, when reporters were traveling around in convoys most of the time, like five or six cars, and in each one of those cars there were two American journalists with their local driver and translator. And one day we were going to an area. I was sitting with two American journalists in the car and in the front seat with the driver, and they were sitting in the back seat. One of the cars in the convoy headed to an area that I knew really well, and the foreign journalists with me, they told our driver to follow the convoy. And I got really upset, but before telling them that, I reached out for my helmet and my flak jacket. They were surprised. They said, you very rarely or never wear your flak jacket and helmet. How come you are doing that now? And then I angrily replied, I said, I'm sensing some danger, and that area where we go fell in the hands of some local fighters under U.S. bombardment. And those who were defeated might fight back today in retaliation. And I strongly advise you not to go there. But they didn't listen to me. They said, we have to go. Everybody else is going there. And I said, don't follow those drivers or foreign journalists. They are ignorant to the region, but I know. So they ignored my warning, and we went there. We got off the car, and we started to talk to some local people who were fleeing the area. And throughout the conversation and the translation, I was very nervous and angry. So about, I think, 10 minutes later, we got back into the car to leave. And the minute we got into the car with the writer, with the two American journalists, we started an argument. And we were in the middle of this conversation when we heard a really big bang. And it was a car bomb. It blew up exactly where we were 3 minutes ago, and it killed about 14 people. One of them was an Australian cameraman. He died instantly, as well as a number of local people. And then our own car was scratched by flying shrapnels. And that was one incident that I really sensed the danger and a car bomb. And it happened because of my knowledge of the area and by analyzing what had happened the day before.
You know, you said earlier also that there were sometimes things that you knew about the way you had to dress or the way you had to walk or carry yourself to ensure your safety. Can you give us an example of that?
Yes. For example, last time I was in Baghdad was April last year. I went to Baghdad and to the city of Kut. It is 2-hour drive south of the city, south of Baghdad, to do some reporting on the sectarian violence and the internal displacement, Shiite people being driven out of their neighborhoods and Sunnis the same way being driven out by Shia militia. I went there and the situation was really, really dangerous. I'm sure it is more dangerous now, but it was very tense at that time. And in Iraq, it's unlike many other places where a war is going on, because in Iraq, you don't know your enemy. Your enemy is everywhere. You might get caught up in a firefight between insurgents and the Iraqi police. You might get caught up in a firefight between American troops and insurgents, or you might be kidnapped by somebody for ransom, by somebody who doesn't like your religious sect, or somebody who doesn't like your ethnicity. The danger is everywhere, and car bombs blow up every day, anywhere, unexpectedly. So I went there to do reporting, and I had my radio equipment, the recorder, all the cable and the microphone, plus batteries and a notebook. I cannot travel around with that bag on my shoulder because I don't want to draw any attention. What if somebody wanted to look into my bag and see all of this? It's not common. They say, in a situation like this, what would you do? Why are you traveling with all of this? And that certainly puts my life at risk. So what did I do was, I put all the equipment I had was inside a bag, and then I would put the other bag, all the bag, inside a plastic bag to look like grocery, that as if I'm going shopping or I just came back from shopping. And before leaving my hotel room, I was carrying the plastic, putting everything in the plastic bag and going into the street. And I never took a taxi near my office or my hotel room. I was walking a few hundred meters away and then taking a taxi so that nobody knows where I was coming out from. And I didn't shave very often, like every 2 days. I did not wear very fancy shoes or iron shirt or any of these things, because it is very important not to draw attention and to keep as low key as possible in a situation like that.
You know, you said that you grew up around war, because there was the long war between Iran and Iraq that you and your countrymen suffered through. And most of the rest of Western journalists, of course, did not grow up with war, although many had experience covering other armed conflict. I wonder if you think growing up around war gave you a better sense of judgment, either a greater willingness to accept risk or a better judgment about prudently avoiding them.
I think it is a mixture of both, because I lost my fear of war after living almost all my life. After I was born, war started in Iraq until now. So I'm not afraid of war at all. And there has been times when one day I was with two American journalists and there was a firefight between two different groups, a Kurdish group and an Arab group near Tikrit, Saddam's hometown. And as they started the firefight, the American journalists, of course, they ran away and they hid behind a very high wall. But I was standing up and I was trying to see who's fighting who and what's going on. And they said, please, duck or try to hide, it's dangerous. I did not care, because that's what I lived, how I lived all my life. When there was bombardment during Iran-Iraq war, I, my brothers and my family, everyone else in the neighborhood would go on the rooftop of the house to see which part of the city was being bombed. And sometimes the bombs were landing near our house, but we didn't care. In that situation, that's how I felt. I traveled around the country. I never cared about anything when I was on my own. But when I was with the American reporters, I had to care about them. I knew they were unfamiliar with a situation like that, and I had to really travel or behave as they wanted me to make sure they are safe.
Now, I have to understand this. I mean, you described a moment ago how when you were traveling in an area, you would be very careful to not appear conspicuous. Old shoes, you know, a day-old beard, your gear put in a plastic bag which could have looked like groceries, so as to avoid the risk of being identified and attacked. That, you were very careful to avoid risk. Then you describe a situation when two armed bodies are shooting AK-47 rounds whizzing through the air back and forth at one another, and you're willing to stand up in that case and try to identify the combatants and gather information, not so worried about being harmed. Why is the second situation less risky?
Because, as I described earlier, when you know your enemy, you are most of the time in a safe situation. Because when there's a firefight between two groups, you know who is firing upon who or who is shooting who, then you know who is your enemy. You can, as a journalist, stay with this group. When I was wearing old shirt, a day-old beard, and hiding all of my equipment in a plastic bag, it was because I was in a situation that everything looked suspicious and I was surrounded by invisible enemies. I did not want to get really in trouble, and I had to take my own precautions. But in another situation, when there is a bombing or two groups fighting each other, you know who, you know how to take your precautions. It is very different when you know your enemy or when everything is clear before your eyes. No matter how intense is the firefight or the two groups fighting, you at least know the sides or where the fire is coming from. But in a situation like Baghdad these days, everything looks peaceful. You go out into the street, it's quiet, there are not people fighting each other every moment. But in an eye blink, there might be a car bomb. In a moment, somebody might pull up and kidnap you. The situation is very tense, and the enemy is invisible in Baghdad.
We're speaking with Iraqi journalist Ayub Nouri. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Iraqi journalist Ayub Nouri. He assisted many Western journalists as a translator and source guide during the war in Iraq. You spoke earlier about the stress that you felt being responsible for the safety of the journalists who work with you and that other fixers felt, feeling that it was really up to them to keep their foreign journalists safe. And I wonder if you knew of situations where foreign journalists were harmed, but the fixers weren't, and they felt responsible or burdened or guilty because they had somehow not met that responsibility of keeping their journalists safe.
Foreign journalists have been killed along with their fixers, and in many other cases, the fixer has been hurt more than the foreign journalist. And I know an Iraqi woman who was working with an American journalist in Basra. They were both kidnapped in front of their hotel in 2005, and they interrogated them for a few hours. Then they let them go in the middle of the night. The kidnappers or the insurgents told the woman, the fixer was a woman and the American reporter was a man. They had told them to run away and promised that they wouldn't write about the kidnapping incident, but they had lied to them. The minute the fixer and the journalist had run away, they had opened fire. The insurgents had opened fire on them from behind and killed the American journalist was killed right there, and the fixer was shot three times. She survived, and I speak to her. I've met her several times, and she is really regretful. She says that she wished she had died with him, or she wished she was the one who died and the American reporter would survive.
Do you know of many cases yourself where fixers who assisted American journalists were injured or harmed?
Of course. I know many fixers who have been kidnapped, and then most of the time those people who kidnap a journalist and a fixer, they might hate the fixer more because they say that if it were not for the fixer, a foreign journalist from America or from any other country would not be able to come to Iraq to travel around to do anything else. So they blame everything in that case on the fixer. And they hurt the fixer. They don't let him talk or to say anything. And they will blame everything on him for the journalist's presence in the country. And in cases, fixers have been hurt or being killed in Jill Carroll's case in Baghdad when she was kidnapped. They killed her fixer right there, and they took Jill Carroll for a couple of months. Then they released her. But the fixer was killed the first moment. They sometimes hate the fixer more than anybody else or more than the foreign reporter.
You know, earlier in our interview, you told us that when it was clear that the American invasion was coming, that you welcomed it as a chance to remove the horrors of the Saddam Hussein regime and bring a new day of prosperity and democracy to Iraq. Looking back on it, were you wrong or was the invasion mishandled? How do you look on that optimism now and the judgment that you made then?
Yes, I think I was wrong. At that time, I was only 24 years old. I did not have any experience in politics, or I did not have any experience in living in an occupied country, and I was desperate for change. But a country like America, the superpower of the world, with so many politicians from different political parties, Democrats and Republicans, so many universities and experts and scholars, things like that, they shouldn't have invested in my desperation or desperation of a number of Iraqis who want to change. They should have thought about things and thought things over and analyzed the consequences of the war. I just wanted war at any cost, but if the Bush administration really had to listen to people and say what is going to happen, and I'm sure many people advised them not to go into war with Iraq, but they didn't listen. That's why I think I was wrong for being very optimistic about a post-war Iraq. And one other thing is that at this moment, I am not blaming everything on the Americans in Iraq. There is sectarian violence that the only responsible people are the Shiite and Sunni groups, the militia groups in Iraq, who are directly involved in the sectarian violence, in killing people, in driving people out of their neighborhoods, and the political parties in Iraq who have formed the Iraqi government are also behind the sectarian violence, and they are not loyal to the cause of Iraq. The war made all the Iraqis know who's truly working for Iraq and who's not.
Well, Ayub Nouri, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Ayub Nouri lives in the United States, where he's completed studies at the Columbia School of Journalism. He hopes someday to return to Iraq and work as a journalist. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that life-saving advances in health reach those who need them most, gatesfoundation.org. And from Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. cityyear.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Mad Men, advertising men on Madison Avenue in the industry's golden era. A new TV series follows the life of a group of hard-living advertising executives. Our guest Matt Weiner created the series for the AMC cable network. Weiner also tells us about working on the HBO series The Sopranos, where he was an award-winning writer and producer. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. A new TV series generating buzz Thursday nights on the AMC channel is set in a 1960 Madison Avenue advertising firm. It's called Mad Men, and it takes us to a time and place where men in suits and brill-creamed hair ruled the workplace, fueling their long hours with martinis, cigarettes, and Alka-Seltzer. They made their living figuring out what made Americans buy stuff. In this scene, ad man Don Draper, played by John Hamm, is talking to a waiter, played by Mark McGann, about why the waiter smokes Old Golds, instead of the brand of Draper's client, Lucky Strikes.
But what is it? I mean, low tar, those new filters? Why, I mean, why old gold?
They gave them to us in the service. A carton a week for free.
So you're used to them, is that it?
Yeah, they're a habit.
Well, I could never get you to try another brand, say, my Lucky's.
I love my old golds.
All right, well, let's just say tomorrow a tobacco weevil comes and eats every last old gold on the planet.
That's a sad story.
It's a tragedy. Would you just stop smoking?
I think I could find something. I love smoking.
I love smoking. That's very good.
My wife hates it. Reader's Digest says it will kill you.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Ladies love their magazines.
Yes, they do.
A scene from the AMC series Mad Men. Our guest is Matt Weiner, the series' creator, executive producer, and writer of several episodes. He spent 4 years on The Sopranos as a writer and executive producer, where he earned Emmy nominations for his writing, including his work on the final season. I spoke to Matt Weiner about creating Mad Men. Well, Matt Weiner, welcome to Fresh Air. Why was this a particularly interesting moment for American advertising?
Well, it's interesting for American advertising because it's sort of seen as the 1959 is actually the beginning of what's seen as the creative revolution. And it begins with Doyle Dane Birnbach's ad for Volkswagen, which is Think Small, which had a very, first of all, it was done by Jews and Italians, which was not the mainstream in advertising. Advertising was about selling you an idealized version of yourself. And suddenly there was this very subversive joke, basically, about advertising. It was graphically different. It spoke directly to the audience. And it said, we're trying to sell you something. Isn't that funny? Why don't you buy it? And the directness of that appealed to what I think is what's always there in American culture, which is a subversion, a sense of a problem with authority. And once that became part of the fabric of the culture, and that ad was very successful, by 1961, 62, almost everyone was doing that. And what we see as advertising right now, these sort of joke ads that say I'm selling you something or something advertising has always been part of humor. When advertising itself becomes part of that, and mostly fueled by a non-white, even though these people are white, but a non-white shoe advertising firm attitude about it, that really was the beginning of the creative revolution, and it took a long time for people to get on board with it.
You mentioned something about white shoe advertising firms. What are they? What did you mean by that term?
White shoe advertising firms. I mean, it's the establishment of advertising, which is the big agencies and the sort of what we usually see the 50s represented by is this advertising that's now seen as very kitsch, which is a woman in the kitchen trying to get the latest technology, the man coming home with the hat on. The Leave It to Beaver sort of image was promoted by a certain kind of advertising agency, which were the ones that were the most successful. They had just all become publicly traded. There'd been a huge boom in it with prosperity and available dollars. This image was what was being promoted. And then along came something that said, guess what? We know your life isn't like that. We know you're not Ozzie and Harriet. Here's a car for you. Here's a, Avis, we try harder. You don't have to be, we're number two. You don't have to be Jewish to eat Levy's rye bread. All of these ads were done with a sense of humor that says, we know you're not Ozzie and Harriet. But the image of Ozzie and Harriet was promoted by establishment, corporate, gigantic ad agencies.
And Sterling Cooper, the ad agency that's the center of this series, is that a white shoe firm?
It is a white shoe firm. It's a third-tier firm. And I think as the show progresses, people will realize that dramatically, it's more interesting. They're pretty much on the wrong side of everything. One of the things I'm interested in is this white male dominance of the marketplace and this kind of white tiger that's disappearing. And they're either going to have to get on board or not get on board. But they're not one of the big agencies. I think people think it's BBDO or something like that, but it's actually much smaller than that.
And did you find ad men from this era to talk to and reminisce about?
I have since I wrote it. I wrote the script 7 years ago, And I really had a hard time finding any human beings who had been there who wanted to talk to me, mostly because a lot of them were dead. These are very hard living people, and that was what was so appealing about it. Now, since then, I've run into people, although most of them started in 62, 63, 64. What I have found is a lot of women, because I think there was a huge influx of women coming to New York in the late 60s to be secretaries and to find their way. And I've contacted a lot of those people have contacted me, and I've got the reports I've gotten about what's there have been amazing.
Let's listen to a cut from the first episode. Sure. And this is one where there's sort of two parts to it. And at the end of it, I'm just going to explain it. I mean, what we hear is sure. The central character of the series, whose name is Don Draper, played by John Hamm. And he's sort of lecturing one of the junior members of the firm, Pete Campbell, who's played by Vincent Kartheiser. And one of the things he's lecturing him about is the way this character, Pete Campbell, had just spoken to a new secretary who's played by Elizabeth Moss. So it begins with this character, Pete Campbell, sizing up a new secretary. Let's listen.
Where are you from, honey?
Miss Deaver's secretarial school.
Top notch. But I meant, where are you from? Are you Amish or something?
No, I'm from Brooklyn.
Well, you're in the city now. Wouldn't be a sin for us to see your legs. If you pull your waist in a little bit, you might look like a woman.
Is that all, Mr. Draper?
Hey, I'm not done here. I'm working my way up.
That'll be all. Peggy, right?
Yes. Oh, and it's time for your 11 o'clock meeting.
Oh, and sorry about Mr. Campbell here. He left his manners back at the fraternity house.
She's a little young for you, Draper.
Future Mrs. Pete Campbell's a very lucky woman. When's the wedding again?
Sunday. Did Ken tell you about the bachelor party tonight?
He sure did.
So do I get first crack at her? Word is she took down more sailors than the Arizona.
How old are you, Pete?
I just turned 26.
I bet the whole world looks like one great big brassiere strap just waiting to be snapped.
Hmm? You are good with words, Draper.
Campbell, we're both men here, so I'm going to be direct.
Christ, are you already sleeping with her?
Advertising is a very small world, and when you do something like malign the reputation of a girl from the Steno pool on her first day, you make it even smaller. Keep it up, and even if you do get my job, you'll never run this place. You'll die in that corner office, a mid-level executive with a little bit of hair who women go home with out of pity. Want to know why? Because no one will like you.
And that's from the AMC series Mad Men. It's created by my guest, Matt Weiner. I just love that scene. There's so much going on there. one of the things going on there, of course, is this raw ambition. Everybody wants everybody else's office. But it's that lecherous sexism in the office that really jumps out at you. I mean, the kind of things that you would really never hear these days. And when you write scenes like this, you've got to take your own post-Anita Hill consciousness and right. make this dialogue believable. How do you do it, and how do you know you're not taking it too far?
I think that the conversation is derived from the same kind of conversation we have now. You know, there's men do speak this way to each other. They may not be as succinct and witty as these people are, but what I love is what Don is saying to him is this is an office. And you are behaving badly for your goals of achieving success at this office. And you're talking about a woman's reputation. And they're all very, very sort of moral stances as defined by that period. A woman's reputation, your reputation here. What is the death of a salesman? He was liked but not well liked. These are all the standards of how to behave in a business environment. And at the same time, Don is saying, like, you know, you're never going to have sex in the future because you're being inappropriate. He's not saying anything about what he thinks of women or how women are to be treated or how they're to be treated in his personal life. And what I really try and do is just think about I try to be honest. And have people speak to each other in a frank manner. There's so much lying that goes on in this environment, and I love the concept of the audience knowing something about a character that the other character in the scene doesn't know, and that's just a dramatic construct. Pete has a line, this anti-Semitic slur that he says that's, you know, very glancing, but if you're Jewish, very specific. He says, adding money and education doesn't take the rude edge out of people. And that's something I overheard in my life. You know, that's not old. So what I try and do is have people say things in as frank a manner as possible, and the attitudes being that men somehow, white men, view themselves as us. I think every group views themselves as us and everyone else is them. And there's a security in that. And everything, every comment on every other group, every denigration is really delivered as a kind of, with a kind of kindness, with a kind of pity for the fact that they, that that group does not understand what we are up to.
Did ad executives really have, you know, bottles of bourbon on the credenza and open them up at 3 in the afternoon?
Well, here's where this is not a myth. It depends on who you talk to, and it depends on the agency. I have had I can name names of people who have seen this and said that there is not enough drinking. There was a wonderful email that I got. Bob Levinson was at who's at ICM was at BBDO in 1960 on the Lucky Strike account, and I was terrified to talk to him after he saw the pilot. And he said, "Do you have a time machine? How old are you? Where did you get this?" And he gave it to someone he began working with, Brandon Stoddard, who eventually became in charge of ABC, I think. And the email said, "Look at that. Remember us, the secretaries, the drinking, the smoking." He says, "God, I wish we were that smart." So, and then there's another group of people who are so, it's funny, I think George Lois, you know, who is such an icon of advertising, and of course, his impact was a couple of years after this, but he's been so brash about saying a couple of things about the show. One of them was, why didn't anyone come to him to do the show? And the other one is that we changed the world, and there's this sort of like brashness about it, and how shallow they look, and this hucksterism and this Hollywood image. And honestly, when I read his, when I read his letter about the show, I thought, oh my God, you're confirming everything I thought about the personality of the person that does this.
Wow.
You know, I find that I've anecdotally heard people say, like Jerry Delafemina said to me, there's not enough drinking in it. And it obviously depended on who the person was. And when you hear the stories, they definitely had all their meetings in the morning. They definitely went and got drunk at lunch. And when I say they, it's not everybody, but it's a heck of a lot more people than do it now.
My guest is Matt Weiner. He is the creator of the new AMC series, Mad Men. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, we're speaking with Matt Weiner. He worked for 4 years as a producer and writer on The Sopranos. He is the creator of a new series on AMC. It's called Mad Men. Let's talk about your visual approach to this series. I mean, it looks different. How do you create the visual look of this series?
Well, it was a conscious decision because I wanted to do the period. But I didn't want the audience to have any moment of abstraction. I didn't want to shoot it in black and white. I didn't want to glamorize it. I wanted it to feel like we were in that space and that the people would be real. And the first thing that happened was the ceiling, making sure that we saw that ceiling, because that ceiling exists in all of our workspaces right now, and I thought that was something that would
bring people in. You mean the ceiling in the offices?
The ceiling in the office itself.
Describe it.
It's a drop ceiling with fluorescent lights in a pattern. And there's more venting in it now. There might be some fire safety that there wasn't at that time. But what you see is the typical office park insurance company ceiling, which is a drop ceiling with acoustic tiles and checkerboarded with fluorescent lights. And obviously, you don't see this a lot on TV because it's very hard to shoot, and because fluorescent lights create it, they require a lot of color correction. But once the production designer and I had agreed that it was about the ceiling, and we had a director who was really into low angles, Alan Taylor, our commercial sensibilities sort of overlap at Hitchcock, and we both sort of said, let's take advantage of all this. Then it became a matter of creating the period in a realistic way. And that means that when you do 1960, you are not, someone did not go out to a store and buy everything that day. The women's clothing is not from Vogue magazine 1960, because it wasn't available to people, regular people, until 1962. couture, you know, takes a couple of years to filter down, the hairstyles and so forth. You can't just look at a bunch of magazines. So when you, if you were doing 2007, you can look around and see there are people dressed from the 80s. There are antiques around. There's furniture. There's this, everything that went on beforehand is existing at the same time. So Peggy is wearing a dress from the early 50s, and the hairstyles are different on different women. And then, of course, I felt that television and movies in particular, the glamour, besides having everything from the same period, is usually about a kind of cleanliness. And some of that comes from the fact that it's very expensive to put in the detail that you need. So I immediately said, okay, you look up a picture from a Herman Miller catalog of one of these offices. The desks still exist. They're available at Staples. We put these desks in. You never see any of the wires from the telephones and the typewriters and the lamps, because when you take a picture, you don't want to see that. Well, you see all that in this. You see the full ashtrays everywhere that we grew up with. You see sweat stains and wrinkles and hair out of place. You see clutter. You see personal items. You see bowls of candy. You see everything but gum stuck on the bottom of the shoe. And I told you I wrote this 7 years ago. And one of the things that AMC gave me complete creative freedom, but one of the things that I added to the script, other than that, I shot the script I wrote back then. One of the things I added was this moment in the pilot where Don looks up at the ceiling and sees this fly in the light fixture. And I know that some people see it as a symbolic thing that he's trapped and he can't come up with an idea, and that's wonderful. But and honestly, as wonderful as that is, that my intention really was to say there is a fly in the light fixture. And that fly is not period. There are flies in the light fixture now, and for a moment you get a sense that this world is real.
You know, I feel like as we conduct this interview, we should both be smoking Camels or Lucky Strikes, because, I mean, yeah, the film is suffused with cigarette smokes, as life was in the 1950s. And in particular, John Hamm, the lead character, handles it so effectively. It's almost like the cigarette is a character in some of his scenes. Did you have to teach actors how to handle cigarettes like as these folks do? And is there a health issue? There's just so much smoke on the set.
Well, first of all, they smoke herbal cigarettes, and there were a couple of actors who smoked when we began who no longer smoke. And I think herbal cigarettes are unpleasant, but they are not addictive. And OSHA, what used to be OSHA, it's approved in the workplace for them to smoke these things. I do not advocate this in any way, and I actually, from a creative standpoint, do not allow anyone who has never smoked in their life to smoke on the show, because you can tell immediately. It just feels like this sort of awkward prop, and it feels, you know, and of course actors love to have the business and love to smoke and love to have it in the scene, but for emphasis or whatever, but John Hamm was someone who had been a smoker at some point in his life, and he got exactly what it was. And there were some lines in the script where, you know, where it says he has the cigarette because he needs it. It's an addictive behavior, like drinking. It's a consolation. You know, I remember watching Jenna Rollins in Gloria, and there's a moment where she has a cigarette after the tension ends, and you just look at that and say, "Oh, that's what it's about. I need my medicine." And so it's not just some habit, it's not just some prop, it's actually part of their personality. And there is a lot of smoking. I don't find that there's any more smoking than there was in my life growing up, but I do try and write it in. I don't just let people come in and light up cigarettes because it's part of the scene. The prop master doesn't walk around beforehand handing out cigarettes to everybody.
Matt Weiner is the creator and executive producer of the AMC series Mad Men. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Matt Weiner. He is the creator of the new AMC series, Mad Men. You worked for 4 years on The Sopranos, and if I've heard this right, you actually got the job on The Sopranos because you sent David Chase this script that you had done years ago for Mad Men.
Yes, the script was 2 years old when David got it, and he finally saw it, and a week after he got it, I was in New York on the show. And it was he was a tremendous fan of it, and he still is. He's been very supportive.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that occurred to me as I watched Mad Men is I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to like Don Draper, the lead character, or not. And it struck me that's certainly true of Tony Soprano.
Well, isn't that wonderful that David was able to create a emotional complexity, because that's the way reality is. And honestly, I'm not here to reaffirm our sense of ourselves. I'm here to be entertaining and show a person that I hope that we identify with, because they're conflicted, because they behave sometimes in unpredictable ways, because they're selfish. It's a lot of negative qualities, and there's also there's a lot of humor, a lot, you know. Irony is like not commercial on some level, but it's so satisfying. So I'd like to think that if you don't know whether to like him or hate him, it's going to keep you interested in him, because in the end, that's how you feel about yourself.
Is there an episode or a scene from The Sopranos that you particularly relish and love?
Oh, there's so much of it. You know, what happens is you start to like the things that other people like. You know, there's things that are particularly satisfying because they've gone over really well. But, you know, there's a scene. I wrote this episode, Luxury Lounge, which is the one where Lauren Bacall gets punched in the face. But there's a scene with Artie Bucco and Tony when in a strip club, where Artie starts talking about how Tony can have sex with this stripper and he can't. And there's this moment of reality that's underlying it, where you just get the idea that these are real people and not everyone can be Tony Soprano. And that on some level, even though Artie is 40 years old, he's just realizing that life isn't fair. And that to me was one of the more satisfying things. And obviously, anything where Edie and Jim are together, anytime they have an argument, it was an opportunity for me to exercise every time you've had a fight and you walk away and say, oh, I should have said this, I should have said that. Well, when you have a couple of weeks to write a scene, you can have them. You know, there was a scene in one of the episodes in this last season where she throws a Yadro at him. And he says to her, when I'm gone, you can live in a dumpster for all I care. And there's just this cruelty to it that is of sticking pins in each other that we do to people we love because we're hurt. And that's been satisfying.
You know, in the 4 years there, I know that you worked as a writer and producer on Becker, right, the CBS series. And
yes.
And then you must have, I mean, you worked on The Sopranos, which has, you know, become an iconic TV series. I mean, one of the most widely acclaimed in the history of the medium. And I assume that you grew professionally. I'm wondering how Mad Men is different than it would be if you hadn't had that experience on The Sopranos. Do you think that work brought something to the project now?
Well, you know, I did write the pilot before I was on The Sopranos, but The Sopranos had been on the air for about 6 episodes. And there were 2 things that I got from it. One is that David Chase was a hero to me because of his age and where he was when this happened. The second was that there was such depth and complexity in the show, and at the same time, it was so commercially successful. The idea that the public really did want to see something good was very contrary to the attitude in Hollywood. And I thought, well, you know, this anti-hero, Tony Soprano, who I identify with, and I don't murder people, if I identify with him, then I can support an anti-hero. And that creatively was there, right there. Not only his inspiration to David's success, but also the content of the show. And then, of course, getting on the show and seeing how the sausage was made, what I really learned, first of all, you get this incredible experience of having someone like David Chase tell you that you're a good writer, which to me, that confidence was something that cannot be replaced. That was an amazing experience. The other thing is to see, without revealing the process too much, but to see the idea of really trusting your imagination and hoping that if you believe something and you think it and you present it in a responsible but entertaining way, that the audience will get it. That they're not stupid. You know, the attitude in network TV, we used to talk about this guy named Timmy, and whenever you, or a two percenter, any joke that you did that someone didn't get had to be cut. and anything that mentioned numbers or that was complex or anything like that. Timmy doesn't like that. Timmy won't like that. And when I was on The Sopranos, what you got right away is everything you thought that they were doing, they were doing. David viewed himself as the audience and the people in the room, and if we liked it and we understood it, that's what we did.
Well, Matt Weiner, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Been a pleasure, Dave.
Matt Weiner, his new series Mad Men airs Thursday night on AMC. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Somerset Maugham's novel Of Human Bondage, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Lives of Others, the film about surveillance in East Germany before the collapse of the Berlin Wall earned international acclaim, including a 2007 Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. It's coming out on DVD. We'll talk with the director, Florian Hinkel von Donnersmarck. Join us for the next Fresh Air.